glasses when I told him how we'd slept in the same room.
Holy shit,
Arthur gasped.
Did you have sex with him?
I gave him a disgusted look, at which Arthur laughed.
I'm just kidding. He has a girlfriend, a hot one. I heard she models for Abercrombie and Fitch.
Who told you that? I snapped, instantly feeling thick and squat. A fat little loser Mr. Larson took pity on once. Arthur shrugged.
That's just what everyone says.
Even though I was grounded, my parents had only a vague sense of when cross-country practice ended, so I could easily hang out with Arthur most days. For the first time, I was grateful I lived so far away that I had to take the train home. Sometimes practice is an hour and a half, other times two, I told Mom. It depends on the mileage of the day. She took me at my word, and so all I had to do was call her from the Jeremy payphone at the Bryn Mawr station and say, "Getting on the 6:37." By then, practice had been long over, and the initial blast of my high had mellowed into thick, warm sludge. I'd placed the phone in the receiver, watched the creaky 6:37 come to a stop with an exhausted white puff. Either I was moving more slowly, or everything else just appeared to be. Arthur's eyes darted over my shoulder to the squash courts behind me and the parking lot behind that. Nannies waiting to pick up kids from practice, their beat-up Hondas pulsing with the commercial-free stretch of Y-100. People have been coming by, ringing the doorbell, and running away. Who? I asked, feeling sick.
Who do you think?
He looked at me accusingly like I'd brought them to his door. Can you just let me in already? One quivering bead of sweat escaped my sports bra, took its time snaking into my underwear. Arthur swung open the door and I ducked in underneath his arm. I followed Arthur up the stairs, three flights that moaned noisily beneath our weight. He had moved out of his bedroom and into the attic over the summer, he'd explained to me the first time he brought me up there.
Why?
I'd glanced around the bare-bones room uneasily, rubbing away the goosebumps on my arms. There was no insulation in the walls, and as a bedroom it felt makeshift, vulnerable, nothing homey about it. Arthur had stuck his hand out the window and tapped the crusty belly of the pipe against the ledge. Some black ashes fluttered away like charred snowflakes.
Privacy, he'd said.
He'd taken very few possessions with him when he moved. Even his clothes remained in his old bedroom, so that every morning before school he used it as a sort of dressing quarters. But one very important object had made the journey north with him, was granted a prime position on a stack of textbooks that served as his nightstand. A picture of him as a child, with his father. It was summer, and they were at the shore, laughing and looking out at the mucky brown ocean. Someone had glued pastel-colored seashells all over the picture frame. I'd picked it up once, quipped, "This looks like a kindergartner's arts and crafts project," and Arthur had snatched it back.
"My mom made it for me. Don't touch it."
Beneath this cherished picture was the Bradley Middle School yearbook, which played an integral role in one of our new favorite pastimes, defacing the class pictures of the hose and the hairy legs. It was more fun to destroy them in their middle school form, braces, frizzy hair, lanky-limbed and ugly. We would do this after we'd smoked and stumbled down the stairs, jelly-legged and giggly, to raid the kitchen. Mrs. Finnerman held office hours in her classroom until 5, then stayed another hour or two to catch up on paperwork. So the place was ours until then. It was the perfect arrangement she didn't know about. Some people lose weight, can't eat when they're stressed. I thought I'd be one of those when everything first happened. But once the acid-flavored anxiety of what would become of me dissolved to reveal what had become of me, the hot new girl already washed up 7 weeks into the semester, food had never tasted so good. Arthur had figured this out years ago, and he was an enthusiastic partner in crime. Together, we came up with all kinds of concoctions to feed our emotional voids. Nuke Nutella, and it becomes a hard chocolate cookie. This was pre-Nutella ubiquity, and I'd asked, "What the hell is this?" when I first came across it in the cabinet.
"Some weird European shit," Arthur had said and shrugged,
and I'd made a face at it, impressed. Or we'd plop a roll of cookie dough on a baking sheet
and shove it in the oven without even breaking it up, roasting it as a log until the outer ends were golden and the inside was raw, eggy mush that we ate with a spoon. All the clothes Mom had bought me at the beginning of the semester were rebelling against me. The opening of my khakis spread like my legs with Peyton's head between them, refusing to close no matter how hard I ran. Today, after we clattered down the stairs into the kitchen, the yearbook tucked underneath Arthur's arm like my future mother-in-law's vintage Chanel clutch, Arthur announced that he wanted nachos. He held the doors to the kitchen cabinets out wide, a conductor directing his symphony. "You're a genius," I said, the corners of my mouth pinching hungrily.
"You mean a ginachos?"
Arthur gave me a sassy look over his shoulder, and I laughed so hard my knees buckled. Then I was lying on the tiles of his old kitchen, tiles Mom would have called fuddy-duddy. The word fuddy-duddy made my sides itch even harder with laughter.
"Tiffany, come on," Arthur scolded. "You don't have much time."
He pointed at the display on the stove. It was 5:50. The thought of not getting my fix centered me. I climbed to my feet and began to pull toppings from the fridge. A shiny block of orange cheese, blood-red salsa, a watery container of sour cream. We arranged our nachos in silence, stoned and sloppily dressing the chips. We took the plate to the linoleum breakfast table and sat, still not speaking, too competitive for the chips with the most cheese. When not one tortilla crumb remained, Arthur got up from the table and retrieved a gallon of mint chocolate chip ice cream from the freezer. He found two spoons, staked them through the pastel surface, and placed the carton on the table between us.
"I'm so fat," I moaned, exhuming a large chunk of chocolate.
"Who cares?"
Arthur stuck his spoon in his mouth, pulling it out slowly, sucking all the meat off the bone. I bumped into Dean in the hallway today. He said,
"You really are a wide load, aren't you?"
I liked the ice cream in the corners best. It melted first, obeyed when I coaxed it around the edge of the carton.
"Fucking rich white trash."
Arthur stabbed the ice cream with his spoon.
"You don't even know the half of it."
I tongued a back molar, chiseling away its thin chocolate coating.
"What don't I know?"
Arthur furrowed his eyebrows at the ice cream.
"Nothing. Never mind."
"Okay," I stopped eating for a moment. "Now you have to tell me."
"Trust me."
Arthur dropped his chin to peer at me over his glasses, and an extra layer of skin gathered in his neck.
"You don't want to know."
"Arthur," I demanded. Arthur sighed heavily, like he was sorry he ever brought it up. But I knew he wasn't. The more sacred a piece of information, the more desperate the gatekeeper is to reveal it, the harder you have to work to relieve her of the burden. That way, she doesn't feel horribly guilty about betraying confidences. What could she do? She was browbeaten into it. I say she because it's an inherently feminine game. And when I look back on all of this now, at the way Arthur was a natural at navigating the ball on the field, I realize it's much more telling of his sexuality than his own declarations, so theatrical, so over the top, that I could never figure out if he was just messing with everyone, playing the role assigned to him, and brilliantly. "I think I deserve to know," I said, my voice full of meaning. "Of all people?" Arthur held up his hands, the universal stop sign. He couldn't take it anymore.
"Okay," he acquiesced.
He speared his spoon in the ice cream and flattened his hands on the table, considering how to tell me what he was about to tell me.
"There was this kid, Ben Hunter."
I remembered the name from the night of the Fall Friday dance, when I'd snuck away with the hose and the hairy legs to watch them all drink at the spot. Olivia's gleeful disgust over seeing Arthur giving Ben a blowjob. Peyton's addendum that Ben had tried to kill himself. His mean conclusion that he hadn't succeeded. I never really believed the first part of the story. It reeked of an Olivia lie, told to assemble a curious crowd with her in the center. Even so, something stopped me from telling Arthur what I knew. There was a small part of me that believed it could be true, and didn't want to know if it was. I couldn't stand the idea that Arthur had been on his knees in the spot, Weirdo number one sucking weirdo number two's dick. Arthur was my intellectual compass, not another raging, lusty animal in heat. Not like me. I pretended I'd never heard the name Ben Hunter before.
Who is he?
Dean made him kill himself.
Well,
Arthur pushed his glasses further up his nose, adding another fingerprint to the left lens.
Try to kill himself, at least.
I abandoned my spoon in the ice cream, so warm and gooey now the handle sunk, slowly as the green quicksand absorbed the tip.
How? How do you make someone try and kill themselves?
Arthur's eyes went dull.
You torture them for years. And then you degrade them by...
He grimaced.
It's disgusting. Are you sure you want to know?
Ice cream gurgled in my throat as I groaned.
Will you just tell me?
Arthur sighed, and his linebacker shoulders dropped further down his back.
You know Kelsey Kingsley?
I nodded. We had history together.
She had this graduation party in 8th grade. She lives on, like, 3 acres. Pool, tennis court, all that, but just a lot of land, too. Anyway, Dean and Peyton and some other soccer douchebags showed up. They were already in upper school at this point, so that was creepy, but Peyton had some boner for Kelsey. He likes some young.
Arthur tipped his chin at me as though I were a prime example.
They convinced Ben to go with them in the woods. They said they had pot.
Arthur spooned up a golf-sized ball lump of ice cream. His mouth was strung green when he opened it again.
I don't know why Ben believed them. I never would have.
Peyton and those guys? They held Ben down and pulled his shirt up. And Dean...
Arthur swallowed and shivered away a brain freeze.
Dean what? Arthur pressed his fingers to his temples, exhaled. He raised his eyebrows at me.
Dean took a shit on his chest.
I leaned back in my chair and steepled my hand over my mouth.
That's disgusting.
Arthur piled more ice cream onto his spoon.
Told ya. Anyway, he shrugged. When they let him go, he ran. He was missing for almost 24 hours before someone discovered him in the bathroom of some Rite Aid by Suburban Square. He'd bought a razor and...
Arthur flipped his right hand over and mimed slicing the skin open, gritting his teeth as though the pain was real.
But he didn't die?
I realized I was holding my own wrist in my hand, applying pressure to an imaginary wound.
Arthur shook his head. People generally don't cut deep enough to nick the major artery.
He seemed proud of knowing this.
So where is he now?
Some institution, Arthur shrugged.
It was only 6 months ago, if you think about it.
Do you talk to him? I asked, watching closely for his reaction.
Arthur scrunched up his whole face and gave a little shake of his head. I like the kid, but he has problems.
With that, he slid the yearbook to the center of the table, nudging the ice cream carton out of the way. My spoon toppled over and disappeared from view.
Let's play with Dean in honor of Ben, he suggested, flipping to our favorite page.
We'd drawn monkey ears on Dean, written monkey see, monkey die above his smiling face. I'd written that originally as monkey see, monkey do, but Arthur had crossed out do and written die. We had other regular pages, too. Olivia's received plenty of attention. I'd decorated her nose with black polka dots, written I need Biore strips.
And a boob job, Arthur had added.
Arthur preferred Peyton over Olivia, though. The yearbook was 3 years old, and we had been in the 6th grade and Peyton in 8th. It was a real accomplishment, but Peyton had been even prettier when he was in middle school. We'd drawn pigtails on either side of his temples, and even though I'd been the one to do it, I had to blink every time we opened the yearbook to his picture. Remind myself that he wasn't really a girl.
Fuck me in my pretty ass, Arthur had written. Choke me while you do it, he'd added,
recently, explaining that one time on a bus ride, Peyton had wrapped his scarf around Arthur's neck and held it there until a purple ring formed.
I had to wear a turtleneck for a fucking month, Arthur had harumphed. And you know how easily I overheat.
Arthur drew a thought bubble out of Dean's mouth.
What is Gentleman Dean Barton thinking today? Before he could decide, the door opened and we heard Mrs. Finnerman calling out a hello. Arthur snatched the bowl off the table and tucked it into his pocket.
"In the kitchen, Mom," he called. "Tiffany's here."
I twisted in my seat to see Mrs. Finnerman enter the kitchen, unwrapping a stringy scarf from around her neck.
"Hi, honey," she said to me.
"Hi, Mrs. Finnerman." I smiled, hoping it didn't look lazy and drugged. Mrs. Finnerman removed her glasses, fogged over in the transition from the cold to the warm house, and wiped them on the hem of her shirt.
"Are you staying for dinner?"
"Oh, no, I can't," I said, "but thank you."
"You know you're welcome any time, dear."
She put her glasses on, and her eyes were bright behind the Windexed pane.
"Any time."
Mr. Larson had warned us it would happen. 2 weeks of grammar, immediately following our discussion of Into Thin Air. This announcement had elicited a dramatic groan from the class and a playful grin from Mr. Larson, one I imagined he gave all his dates, right before slipping his hand underneath the blonde weight of their hair and leaning in for a soft kiss. Given the grueling grammar course I'd suffered through at Mount St. Teresa's, this news was disappointing, but also, to my surprise, fueled me with a sort of territorial adrenaline. "Try me," I'd thought back in September. Gerund phrases, the present participle, noun modifiers, I'd wipe the floor with these amateurs. Now, with Mr. Larson gone and my competitive spirit blunted, I was just grateful for the opportunity to coast. The substitute they'd brought in to replace Mr. Larson, Mrs. Hurst, had the body of a 10-year-old boy and bought her clothes, khakis and pastel-colored button-downs, at Gap Kids. From behind, she easily could have been an upper schooler's annoying little brother. Her daughter was a senior at Bradley, and because she had gotten into Dartmouth, early decision, and had a large, sharp nose and eyes ringed with purple commas, I'd assumed she was a harmless book nerd. But years of dismissal from pretty girls and boys who weren't that horny had turned her into a bitter gossip. Her mother, seated at the head of the classroom, one bony ankle draped over the other, had my number from the get-go. She started on me the day somebody brought in donuts, left over from the yearbook meeting earlier that morning. Mrs. Hurst cut the remaining Krispy Kremes in half, even though there were 11 donuts and only 9 students, more than enough for everyone to have a whole. I assumed she did it so that we could sample other flavors, and took half of a Boston cream and half of a powdered sugar.
"Tiffany," Mrs. Hurst clucked disapprovingly, "jeez, leave some for the rest of the class."
Her insults landed softly like that, enough to arouse a cautious titter from some students, hesitant to get involved with social politics. Honors English, which was filled with the children of Ivy League stage mothers, wasn't her ideal audience. She would have had better luck with the mean degenerates in chem. But she would take what she could get. My friendship with Arthur had not escaped Mrs. Hurst. That, combined with the fact that Arthur was the smartest person in the room, head of the table included, and not exactly modest about it, and he may have had an even bigger bullseye on his forehead than I did. One morning, a particularly convoluted explanation of the appositive phrase prompted Arthur to scribble his own example on the note the two of us had been passing back and forth. Something we did all the time, even in the cafeteria, when we could speak freely. Mrs. Hurst, the dumbass new teacher, I slapped my hand over my mouth to catch my laugh, but a high-pitched sliver escaped. The class froze along with Mrs. Hurst, who took her time looking over her ski pole of a shoulder, her red marker bleeding into the board like a leaky gunshot wound.
"You know what?" She extended the marker in my direction. "I want you to help me with this."
Any other student would have sensed the humiliation that was imminent, would have crossed her spoiled, privileged arms across her chest and refused. Better to take your chances in the dean of students' office than to receive your punishment in front of your peers. But I was still saddled heavily with that Catholic girl fear, and when a teacher told you to do something, you did it. I felt Arthur's sidelong glance as I stood and trudged to the front of the classroom, a dead man walking the plank. Mrs. Hurst pressed the marker into my hand and stepped away from the board, clearing a space for me to step into.
Maybe an example will help, she offered much too sweetly. Write this down.
I hovered the marker over the board and waited.
Tiffany,
I looked under my raised arm at Mrs. Hurst, waiting for the rest of the phrase.
Write that down, Mrs. Hurst cooed. Tiffany.
I wrote my name, dread lining the seams of my stomach. As I dotted the I, Mrs. Hurst continued.
Comma.
I anchored my name with the punctuation and waited for my next set of instructions. Mrs. Hurst said,
A cheap mall rat, comma.
Whether the gasp in the classroom was in reaction to what Mrs. Hurst had said or to Arthur's vicious, fuck you, I'm not sure. But then Arthur was standing, coming around the corner of the table and approaching Mrs. Hurst, who was having a pretty tough time maintaining the cunt look on her face with a 6'2", 300-pound bull charging at her.
Arthur Finnerman, sit right back down in your seat this instant.
Mrs. Hurst's words rambled together, and she shrunk back as Arthur stepped in front of me, a dog protecting his master from an intruder. Arthur pointed his finger in Mrs. Hurst's face, and she gasped.
Who the fuck do you think you are, you dumb bitch?
Arthur, I put my hand on his arm, finding the skin beneath his polo shirt hot to the touch.
Bob!
Mrs. Hurst suddenly shrieked, then again and again with manic regularity, Bob! 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 Bob Friedman, fellow English teacher across the hall, burst into the room looking dazed, an apple bitten down to its core lodged between his thumb and forefinger.
What's happened? He gasped through a mouthful of Fuji.
Bob?
Mrs. Hurst took a shaky breath, but she straightened up, emboldened by his skinny presence.
I need your help in escorting Mr. Finnerman to Mr. Wright's office. He is physically threatening me.
Arthur laughed. You're one crazy bitch, lady.
Hey!
Mr. Friedman pointed the carcass of his apple at Arthur and strode to the front of the classroom, tripping on a book bag and stumbling the rest of the way there, almost losing his glasses in the process. He pushed them back up the bridge of his nose before hovering his hand above Arthur's back. We'd all heard the rumors about the annual sexual harassment seminar teachers were required to take. They were terrified to touch us.
Let's go. Mr. Wright's office, now.
Arthur made a disgusted noise and shrugged off Mr. Friedman's phantom hand on his back. He stomped out of the room, well ahead of Mr. Friedman.
Thank you, Bob,
Mrs. Hurst said, all prim and formal, pulling at the hem of her shirt and puffing out her flat chest. Mr. Friedman nodded and scurried after Arthur. Several students were holding their hands over their mouths. Two nerds were biting back tears.
I apologize for the disturbance, Mrs. Hurst said, trying to sound stern.
But I saw the tremble in her hand as she wiped my name away with the eraser and told me to take my seat. At least she stopped bothering me after that. I didn't see Arthur around school for the rest of the day. After practice, I walked the well-worn path to his house, the leaves on the ground so thin and stale that they just crumbled beneath my sneakers. Arthur didn't come to the door when I knocked. I pounded and pounded, the shutters shaking on the windows, but he wouldn't answer my call. Arthur wasn't in school the next day, either, and I assumed he had been suspended for the rest of the week. But when I sat down at the lunch table, my old lunch table, which was now my permanent home, the shark's eyes filled with tears as she whispered to me that Arthur had been expelled. The word expulsion filled me with the same kind of dread that cancer or terrorist attack did. How could they expel him? He didn't even do anything, not really.
I think it was just the final straw for them.
The shark blinked and a tear formed. I watched in amazement as it rolled down not her cheek, but the side of her face. She flicked it away like you would an ant scurrying along your thigh.
After the fish.
She may as well have been speaking Spanish, which I was just barely holding on to with a C.
The fish?
Oh, the shark shifted in her seat. I thought he told you about that.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Impatience makes me loud, and the shark brought her finger to her lips, shushing me. She lowered her voice.
I don't know. I wasn't there.
but he was suspended last year for stomping on a fish in biology class. I could picture this, I realized. I could picture the way Arthur bared his teeth and popped his eyes at Mrs. Hurst. That face, his large foot coming down on the slippery blue body, flapping and gasping for breath on the wet floor, knowing he had to deliver as much force as possible or the thing would just slide away. Why would he do that? Those guys? The shark shook her head, a mother dismayed by the violence in music videos already. Dean, they dared him to. She brought her fingers to her temples, stretching the skin so that she became an Asian shark. Poor Arthur. He'll never get into Columbia with this on his record. Not even with legacy. Later that afternoon, I pretended like I had a cramp a mile into the 5-mile loop and motioned for the other girls to run on without me. Then I doubled back toward school and covered the same ground in 7 minutes. This time, I held the doorbell down and didn't let up until I felt the house shake with Arthur's footsteps. He swung open the door and gave me a flat look. "Arthur!" I barked at him. "Calm down already." He turned and started up the stairs. "Come on." We sat on his bed and he passed the bowl to me. "Is it really final?" I asked. Arthur opened his mouth wide and exhaled a fat tube of smoke.
"It's really final."
"It's fucking Dean who should be expelled," I muttered.
"There's a reason the cafeteria is named after his family."
Arthur tapped the side of the bowl against the bed frame, loosening up the contents. He offered it to me again, and I shook my head. "Well, maybe he would have been expelled if I'd had some balls," I said. Arthur groaned and launched himself off the bed. I caught my balance as the mattress shifted in my favor. "What?" I demanded.
"But you didn't," Arthur said. "You didn't. So stop with this self-loathing bullshit."
"You're mad at me for that?" I clutched my stomach. I couldn't take anyone else being mad at me ever again.
"You should be mad at you," Arthur roared. "You had the chance to take him down, and you didn't, because you," he launched a hearty laugh straight from his gut, "actually thought you could redeem yourself."
That made him laugh more. "Oh my God, oh my God," he kept repeating, like it was the funniest fucking thing he'd ever heard. I felt everything go still and quiet in me. "Oh my God, what?" Arthur sighed pityingly.
"It's just, don't you see? Don't you get it? You were injured out the gate. And you're just..."
He grabbed his hair. When he released it, tufts stood wildly at all angles.
"You're just such a stupid cunt that you couldn't see it."
I would have taken Dean's hand a million times across my face over this. At least what he wanted, what he was angry he couldn't have, was the most basic primal thing in the world, which was in no way a reflection on me as a human being. The realization that Arthur saw me as something completely different than how I thought he saw me was devastating. We weren't friends, peers, united in our disdain for the hairy legs and hose above it all. I was a reject that Arthur had kindly taken in, not the other way around. I hit back the only way I knew.
"Yeah, well," I sputtered, "at least Dean wanted me. I had a chance. Unlike you, fucking walking around with a 3-year-old boner for him."
Arthur's face crumpled ever so slightly, and for a moment I thought I would cry too. He had defended me, had been the only one to do that besides Mr. Larson. Before I could stop this train from shrieking to life, Arthur's features settled comfortably into a mean, cold stare. And then it was too late.
"What are you even talking about?"
"You know what I'm talking about." I flipped my blonde ponytail off my shoulder. My hair, my boobs, everything about me that had gotten me into so much trouble was suddenly my only weapon to defend myself here.
"You're not fooling anyone."
My eyes darted around the room. I spotted the yearbook on Arthur's desk. I sprung off the bed and seized it, flipping to our favorite page.
Let's see.
I found Dean's picture. "Fuck me in the ass, so hard it bleeds." There was so much scribble on Dean's picture that Arthur had drawn an arrow from Dean's face to the bottom of the page, where he'd written more. Oh, and this gem, chop my cock off. I looked up at Arthur. You'd probably stuff it and sleep with it every night like a blankie, you fucking faggot. Arthur lunged at me. His paws were on the book, yanking it out of my hands. I tried to wrench it back, and when I did, I lost my balance. I stumbled backward, slamming my head against the wall. Like a toddler, I was infuriated by this boo-boo. I wailed and held the place where it hurt. Did you ever stop to think? Arthur huffed, our little scuffle inciting his heart, buried under all those layers of fat. That I don't want to fuck you, not because I'm gay, but because you're disgusting. I opened my mouth to defend myself, but Arthur cut me off. What you should do is hack those off. No one who's ever done anything important has a rack like that. He cupped his own man boobs and shook them violently. If I'd continued on the run, I'd have been climbing the hill on New Gulf Road at the moment. But I still wouldn't have been breathing as hard as I was then. I had my fingers around the picture on Arthur's nightstand, the one of him and his father, laughing at the water. And before Arthur could grab me, I fled. I heard him on the stairs behind me, but unlike in a horror movie, the murderer was obese and slow and stoned. I was by the door, hauling my backpack over my shoulder before Arthur had even made it to the second floor. Then I was outside, and I just kept going until I knew Arthur was well behind me, bent over and braced on his knees, gasping and furious. I didn't stop for almost half a mile, realizing I was going for the Rosemont station now, which was further but wouldn't be a place Arthur would think to look for me. When I finally slowed to a walk, I looked at the picture in my hands, saw the happiness Arthur wanted there, and considered turning back. But then I thought how his dad was a dick. I was probably doing him a favor by taking that picture. Maybe it would help him move on, stop being such a fat asshole. I paused on the side of the road and found a safe place for it anyway, tucking it into a folder to protect all the stupid shell decorations on the frame. I found out a few days later that Arthur enrolled in Thompson High, a public school in Radnor. In 2003, Thompson High sent only 2 students out of its graduating class, 307 total, to Ivy League universities. Arthur wasn't destined to be among them. Chapter 11. It was an email that, had I been 22 years old, fresh out of college, desperate for a job, I would have called up Nell to read aloud. Oh my God, listen to this. Dear Ms. Finelli, my name is Erin Baker, and I'm the HR coordinator for Type Media. We have an opening for the features director at Glow Magazine, and we'd love for you to come in and interview if you are interested. Could I take you to coffee to discuss this week? Pay is competitive. Warmly, Erin. I closed the email. I was in no rush to respond because I was not interested in the least. Yes, features director was a major step up from senior editor, and I could make more money. But I didn't have to worry about money. Not really. No matter how much they offered me, it would never be enough to make a move to a magazine exactly like the women's magazine, only not nearly as iconic. When Lolo had dropped the fucking New York Times magazine on my doorstep like a house cat does a headless mouse. Even though I had written the words, "his member," far too many times in my tenure at the women's magazine, there was a recognition in the name that offered me protection, much like my engagement to Luke did. When I tell people I'm in magazines and they ask where, I never, ever get tired of cocking my head modestly and answering in my best uptalk, "the women's magazine?" That inflection in my voice, "have you heard of it?" Like those smug Harvard bastards. Oh, I went to school in Cambridge. Where? Harvard? Yes, we've all fucking heard of Harvard. I got off on that instant recognition. I did enough explaining in high school to justify my peasant presence among kings. I live in Chester Springs. It's not too far. I'm not too poor. I signed out of my email. I'd write this Aaron Baker back later. Some bullshit. Thank you so much for thinking of me, but at this time I'm very happy in my current position. I tapped my moss-green fingernails on the tabletop, wondering where Nell was. Several minutes ticked by before I knew she had arrived. The heads turning by the entrance to the restaurant were the first sign. The second was the top of Nell's head, the most shocking shade of blonde staring her right at me. I'm sorry, she folded into the seat. Nell is so tall, her spindly legs never fit under the table. She crossed them in the aisle, one booty dangling over the other, the heel sharp and thin as a talon. It was one of those nights. I couldn't get a cab. This place is a direct shot on the one from your place, I said. Subways are for people who work, she grinned at me. Asshole. The server came by, and Nell ordered a glass of wine. I already had one, half down. I'd been trying to make it last, since I was only allowing myself two, essentially dinner. Your face, Nell said, and sucked in her cheekbones. Finally. I'm starving. I know, it sucks. Nell opened her menu. What are you getting? The tuna tartare? Nell looked confused as she scanned the menu, small as a prayer book in her hands. Where is that? It's under appetizers. Nell laughed. I'm so fucking glad I'm never getting married. The server returned with Nell's wine, asked what he could get for us. Nell ordered a burger, because she's a sociopath. She wouldn't even eat the whole thing anyway. The Adderall would have her disinterested after a few bites. I wish that worked for me, but whenever I took one of Nell's blue pills, even the occasional night that Coke turned into morning in the blink of an eye, my appetite always clawed its way to the surface. The only thing that worked for me was pure, hard discipline. When I placed my order, the waiter said, "Just so you know, that's a very small dish." He made a fist to show me. "She's getting married," Nell batted her eyes at him. The waiter made an ah noise. He was gay, tiny, and pretty. Probably had a beefy bear he'd hook up with after his shift was over. As he took my menu, he said, "Congratulations." The word was like an ice cube held to an exposed nerve in a tooth. "What?" Nell gasped. My forehead had creased into that V-shape, which it always does right before I cry. I covered my eyes with my hands. "I don't know if I want to do this." There, it was said, out loud. The admission, like the one tiny pebble that dislodged, tumbled down the mountainside, so insignificant it didn't seem possible the thrashing white avalanche that followed. "Okay," Nell said, clinically, her pale lips pursing. "Is this a recent thing? How long have you felt like this?" I exhaled through my teeth. "A long time." Nell nodded. She hovered her hands on either side of her glass of wine, staring into the red depths. In the dim restaurant, there was no sign of blueness in her eyes. Some girls need that light, those two bright pools, before you can decide, yes, she's pretty. But not Nell. "How would you feel," she said, and there was a quick flare of her nostrils, "if you called it off? If Luke was one day just some guy you used to know?" "Are you actually quoting Gautier?" I snapped. Nell tilted her head at me. Her blonde hair slid off the side of her shoulder and dangled, glinting like an icicle on the edge of a roof. I sighed, thought for a moment. There was this one night, not too long ago, when some belligerent guy had called me an ugly whore because he thought I'd cut him in line at the bar. "Fuck you," I'd sneered at him. "You could be so lucky." The chain around his neck was dancing silver in the lights, and his reptilian skin folded in places it shouldn't have at his age. If only he had resisted the local Hollywood tans like I had. I'd held up my most important finger. "You're adorable, but I'm engaged." The look on his face, that ring's almost magical powers in the way it emboldened me, protected me from the hurt. I said to Nell, "It would make me really sad." "What about it?"
makes you sad.
Because when you're 28 and you live in a doorman building in Tribeca, step out of a cab Giuseppe's first and are planning a Nantucket wedding to someone with the pedigree of Luke Harrison, you're thriving. When you're 28, single, and look nothing like Nell, hawking those same pumps on eBay to pay the electric bill, Hollywood makes sad movies about you.
Because I love him.
The next two words sounded innocent enough, but I knew Nell, and they'd been chosen for maximum impact.
How sweet.
I nodded an apology at her. The silence that followed seemed to hum, like the highway behind my house in Pennsylvania. I grew up so used to it I mistook it for quiet, only noticed it when I hosted a sleepover for the first time with my Mount St. Teresa friends.
What is that noise? Demanded Leah, wrinkling her nose at me accusingly.
Leah was married now. Had a baby she dressed in head-to-toe cotton candy pink for her Facebook albums. Nell brought her hands together in one last plea.
You know, people don't care about you as much as you think they do.
She laughed. That sounded bad. What I meant was, it might only be in your head that you have something to prove.
If that was true, it meant deposits returned, a Carolina Herrera gown sulking in my closet, doing this documentary without my 4-carat tumor, evidence that I was worth more than my previously determined value.
It's not. Now bore into me with her ink-colored eyes.
It is, and you should think about that. Hard. Before you make a big mistake.
This is rich, I laughed aggressively, coming from the person who taught me how to operate every single person in my life. Nell's lips slipped open, moving around words she wasn't saying. I realized she was repeating what I had just said back to herself, trying to make sense of it. In a moment, her expression changed from frustration to amazement.
Because I thought this...
She circled her hands frantically, calling up all this I'd mustered for myself.
Was what you wanted.
I thought you wanted Luke. I thought this little charade made you happy. She clapped one hand to the side of her face and sputtered.
Jesus, honey, don't do this if it doesn't make you happy.
You know, I layered one arm over the other, each a carefully placed barrier to keep her out from where it mattered most. I asked you here hoping you'd make me feel better, not worse. Nell sat up, cheerleader perky.
Okay, Ani, Luke's a great guy. He sees you for exactly who you are and accepts you for it.
He doesn't expect you to be someone you're not. By golly, you should really thank your lucky stars for him. She glowered at me. Our adorable waiter reappeared with a basket in his hands.
Sorry, he mumbled. You probably don't want this, but...
Bread? Nell gave him a dazzling, infuriating smile.
I'd love some bread.
He visibly cheered in her spotlight, the blood dashing to his cheeks and his eyes brightening, sharpening, the way everyone's do when Nell tosses out a handful of her fairy dust. I wondered if he felt it when his arm bisected the space between the two of us, when he placed the basket in the center of the table. The way the air crackled there. Warning. The weeks passed, pushing New York further from the summer, September only half-heartedly fighting the heat. Filming was scheduled to start, whether I was ready or not. I had a dress fitting, and the seamstress marveled at the gap between my waist and the size 6 bodice. I'd balked when I first ordered it. A size 6?
A wedding gown sizing is completely different from the sizing of regular clothes, the salesgirl had assured me. You may be a 2 or even a 0 at a place like Banana Republic, but that makes you a 6 or an 8 in a wedding gown.
Don't order the 8, I'd said, hoping my horrified expression also explained that I would never shop at Banana Republic. I was driving home to the main line on Thursday evening. First day of filming was Friday. The documentary team hadn't received permission to shoot inside the school, something that brought me relief, but not for obvious reasons. Bradley wouldn't want any negative press, and my story would certainly give it to them.
So that implied the angle the documentary was taking was more in line with my own. I wondered who else the team had gotten, besides Andrew. I'd asked, but they wouldn't tell. I'd pillaged the fashion closet the day before I left. Dark waxed jeans, theory silk tops, suede booties that were neither too high nor too low. I got the accessories editor to lend me a lovely little necklace. Delicate rose gold chain, a small bar of diamonds glinting in the middle. It would pick up nicely, tastefully, on camera. I had a professional blow out the messy, trendy waves in my hair that afternoon. The goal was to look simple and expensive. I was folding a charcoal-colored blouse into my weekend bag when I heard Luke's key in the door.
"Hi, babe," he called.
"Hi," I said, not loud enough that he could hear me.
"You in there?"
Luke's Ferragamo shoes clicked closer, and soon his frame filled the open doorway. He was wearing a spectacular navy suit, narrow pants sewn from a fabric so rich it shone. He put his hands on either side of the frame and leaned forward, his chest expanding.
"Nice loot,"
Luke said, nodding to the pile on the bed. "I didn't have to pay for it, don't worry."
"No, that wasn't what I meant."
Luke watched me transfer piles of clothes from the bed into the gaping hole of the bag.
"How are you feeling about this?"
"Good," I said. "I feel like I look good. I feel good."
"You always look good, babe,"
Luke grinned. I wasn't in the mood to joke. "I wish you could come with me," I sighed. Luke nodded sympathetically.
"I know. Me too. But I just feel bad because I don't know when I'll get a chance to see John again."
Luke had been all set to go with me this weekend, but a few weeks ago he'd found out his friend John, who's been feeding orphans in India or some shit that makes me feel like a plastic bitch for what I do, was coming to New York. He would be here only 2 days, and then he was back in India for another year. He couldn't even come to our wedding. He was bringing his fiancée, another volunteer named Emma, who was 25. I was instantly wounded by her beautiful name and her perfect age. I still couldn't believe I was going to be 30 in 2 years. 25? I'd snorted to Luke. What is she, a mail-order child bride?
25's not that young, he'd shot back.
He'd hurt himself and added,
I mean, to get married.
I understood how important John was to Luke. Even though things were chilly between Nell and me right now, if she moved across the world and came back to New York for 2 nights, I would drop everything to see her, too. That didn't bother me. What did was Luke's palpable relief that he was off the hook. That was a pain I couldn't lie away. I emailed Mr. Larson, thinking, "You drove me to this. Want to get that lunch on the main line?"
"I love you, though," Luke said. It came out like a question. "I love you, though?" "You're going to do so great, babe. Just tell the truth."
He laughed suddenly.
"The truth shall set you free. Man, I haven't seen that movie in so long. Whatever happened to Jim Carrey anyway?"
I wanted to tell him that's a line from the Bible, not liar, liar. To just take this fucking seriously for once. I was going into the lion's den with nothing to protect me but a few old green carrots on my finger. How could that possibly be enough? Instead, I said, "He did that Burt Wonderstone movie. It was actually pretty funny." When I'd asked the director, Aaron, what hotel he'd booked me, his eyebrows had jumped halfway up his forehead in surprise.
"We just assumed you would stay with your family."
"They live pretty far out," I'd said. "It would probably be more convenient if you got me a hotel in the area. The Radnor Hotel is pretty reasonable, I think."
"I'll have to check to see if that's in our budget," he'd said.
But I knew it would be. No one had said this to me, but I suspected my story was the pin holding this whole thing together. There was no new light to shed on the incident without my version of events. Also helpful was my chest, which Aaron's eyes seemed to flick to involuntarily. I hadn't slept in my childhood bedroom since college, and even then it was only sporadically. I interned every summer, in Boston the summer of my freshman year, and then in New York after that. I tried to spend the holidays with Nell's family as much as possible.
my sleep was heavenly at Nell's house. It was an entirely different experience at my parents' place, where I would oftentimes lie awake almost all night, gripping a silly tabloid magazine in terror. I didn't have a TV in my room, and this was before colleges dealt out laptops like free condoms at the health center. And the only way I knew how to distract myself from the galloping anxiety, from the disgust that this room, this house, dredged up from the shadowy mind of the past, was to read about the Jennifer Aniston-Brad Pitt-Angelina Jolie love triangle. For me, the only worthy competitor of bleak, starless memory is superficial fluff. The two are successfully and mutually exclusive. As I got older, and as I made more money, it was like an epiphany. I can actually afford to get a hotel. It was easy to blame on the fact that when I came home, I brought Luke, and my parents wouldn't allow us to sleep in the same room. Not even now that we're engaged. I just don't feel comfortable with the two of you sleeping in the same bed under my roof until you are married, Mom said demurely, narrowing her eyes at me when I laughed. I didn't tell my parents that Luke had backed out of the trip until the very last minute. And over Mom's hollow insistence that I stay at home, I calmly explained that the production company had already paid for the deluxe guest room at the Radnor Hotel. And it was more convenient for me anyway, since it put me only 5 minutes from Bradley. It's more like 10, Mom pointed out. It's better than 40, I snapped, then felt bad. Why don't we go out to dinner on Saturday night? Luke's treat. He's sorry about canceling. That is so sweet of him, Mom gushed. Why don't you pick the place? Then she added, I do love Yang Ming, though. And so I tucked my withering body into Luke's Jeep, our Jeep, he keeps correcting me, on Thursday evening. Proud of the New York plate, proud of my New York license. The streetlights caught the bauble on my hand every time I spun the wheel, the collision creating a burst of jade light so sharp it could blind. Philadelphia, just a hop, skip, a cab, a metroliner, and another cab away from New York City, Carrie Bradshaw said once. It felt so much farther than that, like another dimension, like a life of someone else who I felt sorry for now. She had been so naive and unprepared for what was to come. It hadn't just been sad. It had been dangerous. So, what we'll have you do first is state your name, age, and how old you were at the time of the... Aaron fumbled for the word. The, incident. Let's refer to it as the date it happened, maybe. So, how old you were on November 12th, 2001. Do I need more powder? I fretted. I get really shiny on my nose. The makeup artist approached and scrutinized the stage layer of foundation. You're good. I was sitting on a black stool. The wall behind me was black, too. Friday was the day we filmed in the studio, a cavernous room above a Starbucks in Media, PA. The whole place smelled like the burnt, overpriced fuel of diabetic Americans. I would tell my story here, and on Saturday morning, when the students were sleeping off the previous night's antics, we'd get some shots of me around the outskirts of Bradley. Aaron said he wanted me to point out places of interest, the navigational points at which my life became an average before and rarefied after were places of interest now, I supposed. Just pretend like it's you and I having a conversation, Aaron said. He wanted to get this all in one take. I should keep going from start to finish without any break. The emotional continuity of the story is important. If you feel yourself getting teary-eyed, that's okay. Just keep going. I may jump in here and there to keep you on track if I feel like you're digressing. But we want you to just go. I wanted to tell him I wouldn't get teary-eyed, but I might get sick. Heaving clear syrupy bile into the toilet, my hand, out the car window, had been my way of coping for a long time. It's normal and nothing to be concerned about, the grief counselor had assured my parents. I took a deep breath. The buttons pulled on my silk blouse as my chest expanded and retracted. So, we're just starting with the basics, like I said. Aaron pressed the bud in his ear and said in a low voice,
Can I get quiet on the set? He looked at me. We're just doing a 30-second sound check. Don't say anything.
The crew, about 12 of them, fell silent as Aaron counted on his watch. I noticed for the first time he was wearing a wedding ring, a gold one, much too thick. Did his wife have a flat chest and that was why he couldn't keep his eyes off mine?
We get it?
Aaron asked, and one of the sound guys nodded. Awesome. Aaron clapped his hands together and backed out of the shot.
Okay, Ani, when we say take, I want you to state those three things, your name, your age, oh, and this is important, it should be the age you will be when this airs in 8 months.
We do that in magazines, too, I babbled nervously. Use the age someone will be when the issue hits the newsstand?
Exactly, Aaron said. And then, don't forget to add how old you were on November 12th, 2001.
He gave me a thumbs up. In 8 months, I would be 29. I could hardly take it. I realized something that made me brighten. My name will be different in 8 months, too, I said. Should I go by that?
Yes, absolutely, Aaron said. Good catch. We'd have to film that all over again if we didn't get it right.
He backed away from me and gave me another thumbs up.
You're going to do great. You look gorgeous.
Like I was there to shoot a fucking morning talk show. Aaron nodded to one of the crew members. The room was solemn as he said,
Take one.
He cracked the clapboard, and Aaron pointed his finger at me and mouthed, Go. Hi. My name is Ani Harrison. I'm 29 years old. And on November 12th, 2001, I was 14 years old.
Cut, Aaron shouted.
Softening his voice, he said, So you don't need to say hi? Just, I'm Ani Harrison. Oh, right, I rolled my eyes. Yeah, that sounds stupid. Sorry.
Don't apologize, Aaron said much too forgivingly. You're doing great.
I swear I caught one of the crew members roll her eyes. The woman had a bouquet of frizzy curls framing her narrow face, the cheekbones probably more pronounced in adulthood, the way Olivia's might have been. When they yelled cut this time, I got it right. I'm Ani Harrison. I'm 29 years old. On November 12, 2001, I was 14 years old.
Cut. Aaron falling all over himself to tell me what a great job I did.
That woman definitely rolling her eyes.
Let's do a few where you just state your name, okay?
I nodded. Quiet on the set, Aaron pointing at me to go. I'm Ani Harrison. Aaron counting on his fingers to five, pointing at me to do it again. I'm Ani Harrison.
Cut. You feel good?
Aaron asked. And I nodded.
Great. Great. He was all fired up. So now you're just going to talk. Just tell us what happened. Better yet, tell me what happened. You don't have to look directly into the camera either. Just pretend like I'm your friend and you're telling me this story about your life.
Got it. I fought hard for the smile I gave him. Quiet on the set. The clapboard came down like a guillotine. Nothing left to do but to tell. Chapter 12. If it hadn't been for the Swedish fish, I wouldn't have been there, right in the blue-red palpitating heart of it. I didn't even like Swedish fish before I came to Bradley, but they were among the only things Olivia ate, and she was skinny. Rationally, I understood Olivia was skinny not because Swedish fish were an addition to her diet, but because they were her diet. It didn't matter. The urge for that chew, that tang stinging the corners of my mouth, sent me through the cafeteria a second, sometimes third time. Nothing could deter me. Not the table of my former friends located precariously close to the cash registers. Not my pants, now so tight that I'd taken to using a large clothespin as a button. It gave me another inch or two. I made my way through the food atrium, past the deli line, the hot meal of the day, the salad bar, and the fountain soda station. Teddy there, cursing about how the ice machine was always broken, and got in line to pay. Just like at a pharmacy, candy and chocolate and gum were available by the cash register. There were two lines, and there was an awkward moment when I almost ran into Dean.
when we both stepped forward to try to get into the shorter line. I gave it to him without a fight. It was the one closest to his table, the one I tried to avoid.